So let me start by thanking the organizers for the invitation, and it's a pleasure to be here and pleasure to be able to talk to you. So what I'll talk about is a short title of my course is actually Condensation in Real Space. And so most of the stuff that I'm going to talk about were done in collaboration with several people. There's some earlier work which I'll briefly talk about in the first lecture. Were done in collaboration with Musansi Barma, Supriya Krishnamurti and R. Rajesh. These two were students at that time in Tata Institute. But the bulk of the work that I'm going to talk about is done in recent collaboration with Martin Evans, who is here, and Roy Zia. And there's some ongoing work with Shamik Gupta, who is a student at Tata Institute, and also in a different work with Tom Hannay, both of whom are present here in the audience in Edinburgh. But most likely I won't have time to talk about this. So mostly I'll talk about this part of the work. Okay. So here is a rough sort of outline of my talks. And so in the first lecture, since I'm going to talk about condensation in real space though, but I'll start with a very brief reminder of traditional Bose-Einstein condensation that all of you know. But it's good to remind ourselves about that. And then I'll talk about the condensation in real space as opposed to the momentum space in Bose-Einstein condensation. And first I'll sort of talk a very qualitative picture. I'll try to give you, talk about a general scenario. And then we'll talk about, you know, very specific models in which this condensation in real space happens. And in today's lecture, I'll focus on three particular models. One is called the asymmetric random average process. The second one is this chipping model. And the last one is a zero range process. And several people in this room have worked on these different models. And so I'll just talk, and you will see that, you know, out of these three models, only two of them have condensation, but the other one, the first one, will not have condensation. So there are two issues, main issues that come out of that will hopefully come out of the first lecture. One issue is, you know, given the microscopic dynamics, how do we determine the non-equilibrium steady state? This is the sort of theme of the talks of this conference, in fact. And the second issue is that, you know, so one issue is to actually get the steady state, and the second issue is actually to determine if there is a condensation in the steady state. Okay, so these are the two main things that will come out of this first lecture, hopefully. And then in the second lecture, I'll focus on a particular class of mass transfer model in which actually we look for a stationary state or steady state which are non-equilibrium, but they have a very special property, which is this factorizable steady state or so-called product measure. I'll explain to you as I go along. And then, because, you know, the advantage of this product measure is that they are very simple steady states in some sense, so that you can actually calculate various objects explicitly. And so it's good to know that when do we have such kind of product measure, what kind of microscopic dynamical rules will give rise to a stationary state with a product measure steady state, and what is the necessary and sufficient condition for that. Okay, so this we'll discuss in detail in the second lecture, and then we'll generalize this to arbitrary graphs, but most of the time I'll be talking mostly in one-dimensional models. And so this talk, second lecture, is about basically the non-equilibrium steady state, a simple kind of steady state with product measure. And then in the third lecture, I'll come back to the issue of condensation, and I'll address the issue of condensation within this factorizable steady state. Of course, condensation can happen in problems where you have a steady state which is not factorizable, but we'll address this issue within factorizable steady state. And the three main issues that I'll be talking is this: when do we have condensation, the criterion, and then how, what's the mechanism of the condensation, and then, you know, what, which is the nature of the condensation, for example, fluctuations, shape, etc. And mostly I'll be talking about the statics of the steady state. I'll not be talking about dynamics of the steady state. Dynamics of the steady state is also a very important problem, and several people like Claude Godrej and many other people have worked on these problems, but I will not focus on those things. I'll be mostly talking about the static properties of this condensation, and then finally I'll give a summary and conclusion. Okay, so today's lecture is so come back to the this. So I'll start with a brief reminder of the Bose-Einstein condensation that all of you are familiar with. Okay, so what is Bose-Einstein condensation? So it's very simple, all of you know about it. So essentially we have an ideal gas of say n non-interacting bosons, okay? And so these are the single particle energy levels denoted by epsilon 0, epsilon 1, epsilon 2, epsilon 3, etc. And let nk be the number of bosons in a particular level, say epsilon k, okay? And this nk, because they are bosons, so there is, you know, there can be any number of bosons in a given level. So it can be 0, 1, 2, up to infinity. So we have two quantities at our disposal. One is the total number of bosons, total number of particles that I denote by n. And the other is the total energy, which is the summation epsilon k n k, is the total energy of the bosons. Okay. So a configuration of the system is specified if I tell you the number of bosons in each level. So if I know these numbers, occupation numbers, n0, n1, n2, etc., then that specifies a given configuration. And we want to know what is the, you know, probability distribution of this configuration. And if you are in the canonical ensemble where, you know, the temperature or inverse temperature beta is fixed, so basically we go from microcanonical to canonical where beta is fixed, then as you have heard this morning and from Bernard Derrida's talk and other talks also, that the probability of this configuration is just e to the power minus beta times the energy of the configuration. And the energy of the configuration is given by just this nk epsilon k. And therefore, the probability distribution of this configuration, or in other words, the joint probability distribution of n0, n1, n2, etc., is just given by these factors, e to the power minus beta. In energy, I just put nk epsilon k, so n0 epsilon 0, n1 epsilon 1, etc., etc., etc. And then I have a constraint that the total number of particles is fixed to be capital N. Okay. So this is the first example, and there is a normalization constant here, which is the partition function, which is just says that, you know, the total probability must be normalized to unity, and therefore this is just the sum over all nk's of these factors here. Okay. Now this is the first instance of product measure, but because what you see by product measure, we mean that this joint distribution in the steady state is product of individual factors like this. Of course, there is overall delta function constant that the total number of particles is fixed. But in this example, that the individual weights of these different levels, they are actually different because they are you know, different levels like epsilon 1, epsilon 2, etc. And later on, we'll see that in other models that I'll be talking about, that in general product measure, you know, homogeneous system, these weights will be actually same, that is, you know, but in this example it actually depends on the level of the energy. Okay, so we have this object, so we know the joint distribution of this number of particles in the steady state, and knowing that, so now, you know, given this measure, probability measure, then you want to calculate any thermodynamical properties, which is in principle it's easy, but in practice it's difficult. So because of this delta function constraint, so what you do, you go to the grand canonical ensemble. Grand canonical ensemble simply just means that you take the generating function of the canonical partition function. Okay. So this is the grand canonical. So I take the canonical partition function, I multiply it by some fugacity to the power n. Okay. So I put a weight factor z with each particle basically, and then I sum over all possible particles. So this is my grand canonical partition function, which is given then just using the formula in the previous slide. You can write down that this as just a simple of product of 1 minus z e to the power minus beta epsilon k. Z is this fugacity. So how do we determine this fugacity? So as usual in the canonical ensemble, what you have is actually the density of the particles, rho, which is the average density, average number of particles divided by volume. Okay. So this average density is, you can easily calculate from here, it's just the logarithmic derivative of this grand canonical partition function, which is therefore just the sum 1 over v summation k 1 over this object, just from here taking the logarithm. And so the point is that, you know, what we know is actually the density, average density, for example. So the z or fugacity will be determined by inverting this relationship. So z will be a function of rho by inverting this relationship. So that's how we'll determine what the value of z is. And so what happens is, in the thermodynamic limit, if I now take the V going to infinity limit, so I can actually, okay, so let's take a specific example. Suppose we take the bosons, the particles inside a box of size L, then the single particle energy levels are just h bar square k square over 2m, where k is just 2 pi n by L, where n is an integer, okay, with periodic boundary condition. So if you now take the thermodynamic limit, you can replace this sum by an integral here, 0 to infinity k to the power d minus. I am looking at d dimensional problem. This is some volume factor, and you have this this factor in the denominator here. So this is just a function of this fugacity z, okay, and also temperature, but for the moment let's fix the temperature. And then there will be one term here which I am written down specifically, which corresponds to k equal to 0 mode. I just kept it outside the summation. It's just 1 over v times z over 1 minus z, just putting epsilon 0 equal to 0. So this term, okay. So now the point is that we plot this function rho. Let's plot this function z of z, okay. How does it look like? So maximum value of z can be 1 only, because I have taken the zero energy limit to be 0, ground state to be 0, which means that if z cannot be bigger than 1, because then you will have a problem. So z is like, this is like radius of convergence of this series, if you like. So you have a z upper value, maximum value is 1. So as a function of z, I am plotting this object here. And what we see is very easy to see that, if d is less than 2, then what happens is that as z goes to 1, this integral actually diverges. Because in the small, small k limit, you have this object, this behaves like k square. And therefore, this integral becomes k to the power d minus 3 dk. So when you integrate, it becomes k to the power d minus 2. So if d is less than 2, then it diverges in the small k limit. And therefore, this function monotonically increases as z approaches 1. Okay. On the other hand, if d is bigger than 2, then what happens is that as z goes to 1, this integral is perfectly convergent integral. So therefore, this actually approaches a finite value, which I call rho c at z equal to 1. So these are the two different pictures, d less than 2 and d bigger than 2. So what happens for d less than 2 is that if you now look, you are trying to solve by inverting this function basically. So for any given rho, okay, you can always find a solution, a graphical solution. Just give me the value of rho and you can read off the value of z from this curve. Okay, so this will be the value of z. And so for whatever be the value of rho, you can always find the value of z and therefore, in that case, I can actually take the thermodynamic limit V going to infinity, and this term does not contribute, and therefore you do not have any condensation. Whereas for d bigger than 2, I can get the graphical solution, a value of z for a given value of rho, as long as my rho is less than this critical value, then I can find a solution. But when rho becomes bigger than rho c, then of course the z actually approaches very close to 1, and then beyond that you cannot, this object, this function gets saturated to its final value rho c. So then in order to, if you increase rho further beyond rho c, then all the rest of the density, all rest of the mass has to go into this term, and this is what refers to condensation. That means this object now n0 over v becomes of order 1, which means that there is a macroscopically large number of particles that condensed onto the zero mode. Okay. So as I said, for d less than 2, there is always a solution of this functional equation, and therefore you can take the thermodynamic limit, and this object is zero basically. So which means that this n0 is of order 1. So if you take the v going to infinity limit, it goes to zero. There is no condensation. But for d bigger than 2, that this solution exists only for rho less than rho c. And so for rho less than rho c, again this limiting value of this object goes to zero, and therefore there is no condensation. But for rho bigger than rho c, this fugacity actually goes to very, very close to 1 basically. And so when rho exceeds rho c, the extra density rho minus rho c that condensed onto the zero mode basically. So which means that the ground state is macroscopically populated now. The average number of particles in the ground state is of the order of system size, and this is what is called the condensation. Okay. So the phase diagram for d bigger than 2 if you plot density versus temperature. So far I was telling you, you know, for a fixed temperature I was increasing densities. For rho less than rho C, then you have the fluid phase. By fluid phase I mean that the average value of M0 is essentially of order 1. And when rho exceeds rho C, then the average value of N0 becomes of the order of macroscopic size of the system. So finite fraction of particles actually condense under the ground state. And this is the condensed phase. Okay. You could also go by fixing the density and increasing the temperature this way. But in the rho T plane, you have a phase diagram. And the critical density is given by just this integral, which is convergent for D bigger than 2. Okay. So one more last thing before I leave the Bose-Einstein condensation is that if you ask that how do I, you know, what is the distribution of the number of particles in the ground state? So, I mean, you know, in the grand canonical ensemble, it's just, you know, P of N0 is just simply, you know, 1, it's just exponential distribution Z to the power N naught. So for rho less than rho C, so Z is actually obtained, as I said, from the solution of this this functional equation. And so this is just an exponential, and it is n star, therefore is minus of log z, where this z you obtain from the solution of this. And for rho less than rho c, there is always a solution. So therefore this is of order 1. So it's just an exponential curve here. So if I plot pn naught versus n naught, it decays exponentially, and the typical width of this curve is of order 1. But for rho bigger than rho c, what happens, as I said, that the, you know, this integral converges to its value rho c, so the extra bit that goes into the zero ground state energy, basically this is the N0. So from this curve, from this relation, you see that Z is actually 1 minus 1 over rho minus rho C times V, where V is the system size. So if I just plug in here in the value of Z, this object there, and take the large V limit, so what you find is that again it is still exponential, but the typical width N star, typical size number of particles, is now of order V. Okay, macroscopic. So essentially it changes as you go through the critical point, it changes, the width changes from order 1 to order V basically at rho equal to rho C. Yeah.
Above the critical density, is it still valid to make an exponential approximation for the distance?
Well, for this case, ideal Bose gas, you can do it. Okay, as you will see in the other case, you can't in general. Okay. Okay, but you know, for the ideal Bose gas, you can actually get away by with the grand canonical ensemble.
Satya?
Yeah.
There's no power law in front of the exponential? Or
in this case, there is no power law.
I see.
No. Okay, so that's all we want to sort of, you know, remember from this, from our basic Bose-Einstein condensation. And now, I'm going to go talk about condensation in real space. Now here, of course, as I said, you know, condensation happens in the k equal to 0 mode, that is the, you know, in the ground state, in the energy space or momentum space, if you like. Okay. And what we want to now talk about is condensation in real space. What do I mean by that? So before I go into specific models and tell you exactly how it happens, I mean, I'm going to talk about very qualitatively the scenario of a real space condensation, okay? And then we'll sort of make it more specific as we go along. So what the picture I have in mind is the following. So this will be very qualitative. So, just to give you a rough scenario, rough picture, what we have in mind. So again, now imagine that again you have a, you know, box of size, linear size L, or something like that, and you have some particles or some mass or any conserved quantity. It could be energy, it could be mass, it could be particles or whatever. And you imagine that there is some kind of dynamics, some kind of transfer dynamics, that is, you know, stochastically these particles are moving around. So for example, you know, the, you know, asymmetric exclusion process could be one example, and many other examples like that. Okay, so we have some dynamics. I'll be more specific later, but imagine that there is some kind of dynamics of these particles. And what we are imagining is a scenario which is the following, that when the number of particles is small, that is number of particles, you know, density if you like, density is small, then these particles are homogeneously distributed inside the box. And this is what we'll refer to as low density, so-called fluid phase, okay? So it's completely homogeneous. Whereas, when you increase the density beyond some critical value maybe, okay, at the high density, the situation changes. The high density, what happens is that there is still a background fluid, of course, okay, I'll not be more specific more than right now, but we'll see later on. There will be a background fluid, but in addition, there will be a condensate here sitting. By condensate, I mean that the macroscopically large number of particles sitting in a localized region in space, okay. So this is the these red spots here which is what I call it the condensate, and the number of particles in the condensate will be of order V. So for example, if you are talking about lattice model, this will be one site carrying a thermodynamically large number of particles. Okay, and the scenario we are thinking of is that this object, then this condensate, will actually coexist with a background fluid. Okay, so, and the other important point is that, I mean, with difference from the Bose-Einstein condensation, is that in these systems, this condensate actually can happen at any point. I mean, in this particular example, you see that it's happening here, the condensate is forming here. But you know, if you do your simulation, or you know, if your dynamics for another sample, it might form somewhere else, and it might form somewhere else. So all, you know, it can form equally likely at any place inside your system. Okay, so in that sense, this system is actually, so there is a, you know, this is a translational invariant system as opposed to the Bose-Einstein condensation, because Bose-Einstein condensation, as I told you, that each level of the energy, so there is a, you know, there is a specific energy level which characterizes the levels, but here, you know, this object can sit any one of these boxes here, and all the boxes are equally likely to have the condensate. Okay, so in other words, in a given sample, what happens is that this condensate forms. So if you have a finite size sample, what you see is that this condensate forms, and then, you know, maybe it will leave for some time, and then it slowly dissolves, and then it will form somewhere else. Okay, so there is a time scale associated with the flip of the condensate. So this is what I refer to as the dynamics, which Guzrich and other collaborators have worked on. So there is a flip time of this condensate to dissolve here and form somewhere else in a finite size system, and the typical time scale, you know, scales like the power of the system size. But in a given sample, if you take the thermodynamically large L, then, you know, once it forms anywhere, one particular point, you know, it just stays there because it takes infinitely long time to get out from that place. And so in that sense, the translational invariance in the system is spontaneously broken by the dynamics for rho bigger than rho c. Okay, so this is the sort of picture we have in mind. So a useful analogy to remember this picture is, imagine that, you know, UK 5,000 years back, and so, you know, population was very less, and there were, you know, people, there were all kinds of people were distributed all over UK. This is not a UK map, but whatever, you know, they were distributed all over it. And then, you know, but if you look at the situation now, where the density has increased considerably, and what you see, okay, there will be big cities like Birmingham, Manchester, I don't know, Edinburgh and other places, but there is one London, okay, in which captures a finite fraction of the whole population, basically. And so this is the London, basically. Okay, so what is the signature of this condensation in real space? So the signature is the following. So what is the sort of simplest quantity that we would monitor in order to see this condensation? Of course, you know, if you just calculate the average density of average number of particles at a given site, which is just simply rho, so this is not a good measure, because this will be same everywhere. Okay, so you can't really distinguish whether there is a condensate or not. Okay, so it's not a very good measure. So what we should look for is actually the simplest quantity that carries the signature of this real space condensation of this scenario is the single site mass distribution, P of M. That means, you know, I ask, what is the fraction of sites which have mass M in your system? Okay, so if you are in the fluid phase, then what happens is that this PM typically, as we will see later in specific models, that typically decays exponentially, for example. Okay, and this width is of order 1 essentially. So much like as in the Bose-Einstein case, essentially in the fluid phase. But the big difference is that when rho becomes bigger than rho c, when you are in the condensed phase, okay, so what happens there is, I mean, you can imagine that, you know, this PM, imagine that this is the, so PM in the analogy to the city, so M is like the population. So you are asking, you know, how many cities are there with population, let's say, you know, 10,000, with population 20,000, with population 1 million, and so on. So, you know, the histogram, you are just plotting the histogram. So this is just the number of cities with population M divided by the total number of cities. Okay. And so, you know, it will have some distribution. Usually, typically, it will be slower than exponential. Okay, I mean, it could be power law, it could be stretched exponential, and so on. And this will decay. But then, you know, in a finite size system, it will just drop to zero, basically, at some value of this thing. But then, if you go further along, then at m, when m is of order rho minus rho c times l, okay, so that means, you know, let's say population of 10 million, and then suddenly we'll see a bump here, which refers to London basically. So that means there is, you know, there is a, with a very little probability, which is typically of order 1 over L, there is a little bump here, which shows the existence of the condensate. Okay. And this is the picture we'll keep coming back again and again and again. And one of the things that I would like to sort of understand throughout this talk, this course, is actually the, you know, how to determine the distribution, this PM versus M for rho less than rho C. How does it change as we go across the critical point rho C, and how does one calculate the distribution, the shape of this little bump here? Okay, so this is the, this is our main objective would be. So this is the, this is the, what we call the additional condensate. So here is the fluid phase, you know, background fluid, which refers to this part. So this condensate is actually coexisting with this background fluid. And so we would like to know what is this, you know, how do we calculate this single site mass distribution in a given model where this condensation happens. Okay. So before I go into these specific models, just to show you that, you know, that the condensation actually, real space condensation happens in many real examples. For example, traffic flow on a highway, the traffic jam is an example of a condensate basically. Then metallic films, what is called the sintering process basically. So there is aggregation and fragmentation of clusters, okay. I'll talk about it more later if I have time. And then shaken granular glass, you know, if you have, you know, granular glass with, you know, various containers, and when you shake them, if there is a sort of, you know, hole between different containers, then it turns out that in the end with all the particles, you know, condensed onto one single box. Then there is, you know, gel formation in polymer network, growing networks where you have a giant component which is like the condensate. Then there are various examples of wealth condensation, phase separation in one dimension. So there are many, many, many systems which people have studied, which carries the signature of condensation in real space, as we'll see as we go along. But what is common in many of these, most of these systems, and this is the sort of focusing point of this, that there is some microscopic dynamics, okay, and which involves some kind of mass transport. For example, in the example of the city formation, is it, you know, population migration from one place to another place, which actually, you know, gave rise to finally this condensate in some sense. And so there is a microscopic dynamics, okay, which involves some kind of mass transports, which means some kind of particle transport or mass transport from one position in space to another position. So that's the sort of one basic ingredient in all these different models, okay. And typically, these microscopic moves violates detail balance, which means that, you know, it, the system will reach a stationary state, but the stationary state typically will be non-equilibrium in the sense that the detail balance is violated. Okay, so it's a non-equilibrium steady state problems you're talking about. And then, you know, the question is that, you know, what kind of microscopic dynamics would lead to a non-equilibrium steady state where we'll have a condensation transition. Okay, so this is the key point focus of this question. So now what I'll do is I'll talk about three specific models in one dimension, okay, just to make it more specific and more clear. So the first model is the asymmetric random average process. In short, it's called ARAP. The second model is chipping model, which I'll describe. And the third one is the zero range process, which is called the ZRP. Now I chose these three models because, you know, they have been well studied in the literature. They are very simple, but more importantly, they actually are very illustrative of the general principles that I'll talk about later. Okay. So let me start with the first model, which is the asymmetric random average process. So what is the model? So it's a very simple model. So the model is that you have a ring, one dimensional ring, okay, of L sites. At each site, you have a mass, Mi, which could be discrete or it could be continuous. For the moment, we'll just think of discrete mass basically. So Mi is the mass at site I, and the total mass, which is the sum over all Mi, total mass is an object which is conserved by the dynamics, and the dynamics I'll describe in a minute. So this is a conserved quantity in the system. Okay. So this is a closed system. So what is the dynamics? So dynamics I'll describe in discrete time. Okay. So all sites are updated simultaneously. So this is, what is the dynamics? So at each time step, what you do is you choose, so suppose now think of Mi as a continuous mass here, okay? And you just choose a fraction of this mass Mi. So mu I is just some random number ri times mi, and this random number is a fraction, so it lies between 0 and 1, and they are drawn independently at each site from a common distribution which I'll call psi of r, and mostly I'll talk about the uniform distribution, which is psi r is just 1 for r between 0 and 1 and 0 outside. So you just, you know, just call RAN3 or any other program that you are program of calling random number generator, and you just choose a fraction at each site. Okay, so once you have chosen this fraction, that's the first step. The second step is that with probability p, so I introduce a parameter p here, where p lies between 0 and 1, it's a probability. So with probability p, you actually transfer this mu y to its right neighbor. Okay, so each guy basically, and it's updated parallel, that means, you know, updated simultaneously. So each site basically transfers with probability p the mass mu y that was chosen randomly, and you just transfer it, and with probability 1 minus p you don't transfer it. Okay, so that's the dynamics. Okay, now why did I introduce this parameter p here? Because it's quite useful, because p equal to 1 case, you can see it's a fully parallel dynamics. That means you definitely move the mass to the neighbor. Okay, so that is the that is what we call the parallel dynamics. That means, you know, that all sites are updated simultaneously, basically. Whereas if I take the limit p going to 0, for example, if I choose this p to be of order dt, where dt is the microscopic time step in continuous time, then this is just a random sequential dynamics, because, you know, if you ask what's the probability that two sites, for example, you know, one site here and one site there, what's the probability that both will be updated, that will be of order p square, but p is of order dt, so therefore this is of order dt square. So in the limit of dt going to 0, the probability that two sites will be updated is basically 0. Okay, so essentially p going to 0 limit corresponds to random sequential dynamics. So it means that basically effectively it means that you choose one of the sites at random and update it, and then you choose another site at random and update it, and so on. Okay, so this is the continuous time dynamics, if you like, and this is the discrete time dynamics, the fully parallel dynamics. So this parameter p actually interpolates between this random sequential and the parallel dynamics. Okay, so that's that. So it's quite often in many problems it's actually very useful to introduce this additional parameter p, so that you can actually see, you know, the two cases, random sequential dynamics and fully parallel dynamics. And as we'll see later, that, you know, this is actually sort of an important thing, because often the steady state for fully parallel dynamics is quite different from the steady state with random sequential dynamics. Okay, so this is the model. So it's a very simple model. And what questions you want to ask? So the question you ask is a simple question, that what is the mass distribution in the steady state? Okay, in particular, we would like to know that what is the joint distribution of mass at different points, m1, m2, m3, ml. I have L sites in the system, in the limit t goes to infinity. Okay, and in particular, if I know this, then from that I would like to calculate the single site mass distribution, which is PLN, which is just, you know, you just have to keep one of the masses fixed at n and integrate over all the rest of the masses. Okay, so this is the object we are after. As I said, you know, as I was talking about the condensation, that this was, remember, this was a single site mass distribution which carried the signature of condensation. So therefore we are eventually we are interested in this object. Okay, so let's discuss what happens to this case. So first consider the p equal to 1 case, which is the fully parallel dynamics. So what happens here, what we can show is that, so I'm not going to show you in detail, but I'll just tell you the main results, which is that it turns out that the steady state, that is joint distribution, factorizes, okay, which means that I can write down this, the joint distribution of masses, as some function m1 times some function of m2, some function of times ml. Note that all these functions are exactly same for each 1, 2, 3, each sites basically, unlike in the Bose-Einstein case, which was heterogeneous, where the function f depended on site, but here it depends, it's the same for each site, so it's a homogeneous system. And there's a delta function, of course, because the total mass is conserved, as I said. And this object here is a normalization constant, just the partition function, which is the multiple integral of this f1, f2, fn, fn with this constraint here. So it turns out that for this particular case, p equal to 1, you can actually solve this model exactly. And it has this, exactly this steady state, where this fm turns out to be simply just m. Okay. So therefore, you can actually calculate the single site mass distribution just by integrating this object here. And if you take the thermodynamic limit, it turns out that, you know, it's just a simple functional form, which is the m times e to the power minus 2m over rho. So it looks like this, and this weight is a water one, and as you see that there is no condensation here. Okay. Whatever be the density, as I increase the density, it always remains a water one. There is absolutely no condensation. Okay. Now what happens when p is not equal to 1? So condensation or not, you know, the steady state of this model is, you know, it's a very simple model, and the steady state of this model is itself is sort of interesting problem to study. So for p less than 1, strictly less than 1, including the p going to 0 limit, which is the random sequential limit, what you can show, prove rigorously, that the steady state is not factorizable. That means you cannot write down the joint distribution of masses as product of the individual distributions. Okay. So this is a rigorous proof, you can show that. Now, however, you can ask, well, suppose I assume factorizability. Okay. That means, you know, in some sense it's like a mean field theory, because you're assuming that the joint distribution is actually a product of individual distributions. So suppose I assume factorizability, even though I know it's not exact, but let's take it as an approximation and calculate this mean field single site mass distribution, which can be calculated analytically. And it turns out that in the limit p going to 0, for example, random sequential limit, this object is just 1 over square root of n times e to the power minus m over 2 rho, which is different from the parallel case. Parallel case, remember that this, you know, the power in front was m, but here it's 1 over square root of m, so it diverges. Okay. Whereas when p between 0 and 1, it turns out that you can actually calculate the Laplace transform of this function exactly, but not inversion of Laplace transform is a bit difficult, but you can calculate the asymptotics quite easily. So it turns out that in the limit m goes to 0, it diverges like a power law with an exponent beta which depends continuously on p, 1 minus p over 2 minus p. And for large m, it decays exponentially with a factor alpha p, which also depends on p in this fashion. Okay. So then you can ask, well, this was an approximation. I know that this steady state is not factorizable. However, let us just compare this mean field mass distribution with the true PM. By true PM, I mean which you obtain numerically. Okay, for p less than, so for p equal to 1, I know that the steady state is exact. Okay, but for p less than 1, I know that the you know, the product measure is not exact. However, you can just compare, you know, because you have an exact result, analytical form for this mean field result, and assuming product measure, and let's just compare with the numerical one, and what you find, remarkably, that they are indistinguishable. Okay, so let me just show you one curve. So this is the random sequential case, for example, p going to 0 limit, and okay, I mean, you can't see the, you know, this is these two curves on top of each other for all m, not just for large m. For all m, they are single site mass distribution obtained from the product measure is indistinguishable from the real one. Okay. So what is the conclusion? So let me just summarize. So for p between 0 and 1, so even though the joint distribution is not factorizable, the single point distribution seems identical to the mean field. So how is that possible? Well, the point is that, you know, it doesn't exclude. What happens is that, I mean, as Bernard Derrida was explaining to you, if you write down the master equation, so for single point function, so on the right hand side, it will involve 2-point functions. Okay, it will be some functional of the 2-point functions. Okay. And then if you write down the 2-point function in an infinite system, that will involve, for example, some other functional of the 3-point functions. And similarly, 3-point, so you have an infinite hierarchy of these equations. Now, what you can prove is that in general, you know, you cannot just, you know, if you assume that they factorize, then you cannot satisfy all these equations. Okay. However, I mean, it seems that for p less than 1 between 0 and 1, that, you know, if you factorize this one here, okay, if you assume that pm on m2 is just a product of pm on m2, then the result of then pm closes onto itself, and you can get an explicit expression of pm, that is the mean field pm I talked about, and that seems to be exactly identical, okay, to the real one actually. However, you can prove that this 2-point and 3-point, 3-point, for example, doesn't factorize. So 3-point you cannot write down as product of the as product of the three functions. However, the 2 points seems to be factorizing. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is only in the thermodynamic limit also.
Yeah, this is in the thermodynamic limit. Yes. I'll talk come later to a finite size system later. Okay. So. Okay, so this is a sort of interesting point about the steady state, that even though the, you know, this factorizable property does not hold for the full joint distribution, but the 2 point function seems to, I mean, the single point function seems to be the same as if it was obtained from the factorizable steady state. Okay. And so you can generalize this this asymmetric random average process. So far I was talking about uniform distribution, okay, where psi r, the, you know, distribution of the random number, the fraction of mass that you move from one place to its neighbor, was one, you know, uniform distribution. So then, you know, Zeilen and Sachs-Snyder, they actually generalized to the case when this is of this form with a parameter n here, n has to be bigger than 2. So n equal to 2 is the uniform case, but for n bigger than 2, it's a distribution basically. And for this case, for the p equal to 1, fully parallel dynamics, they proved that the product measure is again exact. And it's given by this form, where okay, you have some power here n to the power n minus 1. So for n equal to 2, you get back the previous uniform result essentially. Okay. So what did we learn from this little exercise? So the thing that so one question is that when does the product measure hold? We saw that, you know, for p equal to 1 it holds fully parallel dynamics, but for p less than 1 it does not hold. And then you can ask that, okay, I mean, so we have at our disposal this distribution psi of r. So what classes of psi of r would actually lead to product measure? Okay. I mean, you know, for example, here is one particular family of psi r for which the product measure is exact. But you can ask, are there any other classes for which the product measure holds? Or, you know, so what is the condition under which you can get product measure? So that's the one question that comes out of it. And the second thing that we saw, that there is no condensation transition in the asymmetric random average process. Question is why? What is the criterion for condensation? Why didn't we see condensation in this model? Okay. So now let me come to the second model, which is the so-called chipping model. So this chipping model, there is an off-lattice mean field version, was first considered by Kropitsky and Redner way back in 96. However, because it was an off-lattice model and they took the thermodynamic limit right in the beginning, the existence of condensate was not realized in this work. So I'll talk about instead a lattice model. So here is the model. So again, you have a ring of L sites, okay? And now, you know, now let me assume that the mass is discrete. So at each site, I have some mass, some number of particles if you like, mi, which is a discrete positive integer, okay? And the total mass or total number of particles is just summation mi, which is rho times L, where rho is the density. And this is a conserved quantity by the dynamics again. So it's a closed system. So what's the dynamics? And here I'll talk about dynamics in continuous time, but you can also, you know, study the model with parallel dynamics. But let me just, you know, focus on continuous time just for simplicity. So I'm talking about continuous time. So in a small time interval delta t, the following things can happen. So what are the things? So first move is that the cluster diffusion plus aggregation, which means that you have a block here, okay? So let's say I have 4 particles here. So I move all the 4 particles, okay, with some rate d, so rate d, that means with probability d times delta t. So with this probability, I, you know, take the whole block and I move randomly to one of the neighbors. That means I either move here with d by 2 delta t or move to the right with d by 2 delta t. And once it goes there, it adds to the existing number of particles there. For example, if this guy goes there, it becomes 6 here. Okay? Or if it goes there, it becomes 5 there. Okay? So this is the first move. Okay? Whole block is moving to the neighbor. And the second move is the chipping, which is that, you know, instead of the whole block, you just take the top guy, okay, just one unit, one particle basically from the top. And with rate u by 2 or probability u delta t by 2, you move to the left, and with probability u delta t by 2, you move to the right. Just chip off this top guy to its neighbor. Okay. So this happens with total rate u delta t, total probability u delta t, and with probability 1 minus this 2 d plus u delta t, you do nothing. Okay. So that's the model. So essentially, you have two parameters at your disposal. One is the density, which is the total number of particles divided by total mass divided by system size. So this is fixed by the initial configuration. So rho is given to me, mass density. And the other parameter is this relative rate W, which is U over D. U is the rate of chipping and D is the rate of cluster aggregation. And you can rescale time so that you can absorb this, this object here and make it 1. And then it just appears here as U over D. And so let me call that as W. Okay, so I have these two parameters, rho and W. And you ask, what is the steady state of this model? Okay. So I have these little, you know, little boxes here, match boxes that I got, just to show you this model. So we have this, you can take the match boxes at the end of the talk, if one wants to. So you just, you know, so basically there are two moves. Either you move the whole thing, they are overlapping, okay, something like that. Okay, so you can move the whole thing to the left or to the right with rate D, rate W, relative rate, or you just, you know, just move one object to the left or to the right. Okay? That's all. So, so again, we ask the same question. What's the joint mass distribution in the steady state, in the long time limit? What's the joint distribution of masses at different sites? And in particular, what is the single site mass distribution? Since my masses are discrete, now I just have to take the joint distribution, keep one of the masses fixed at M, and sum over all the rest of the masses. Then that gives me the single site mass distribution. And as I said, there are two parameters, rho and W. So I ask in the rho W plane, what is my phase diagram? By phase diagram, I mean, what is the behavior of this object single site mass distribution for different values of rho and W? Okay. Is there a phase transition? The answer is yes, there is a phase transition. So what is the phase transition? So in this rho W plane, so it turns out that there is a critical line here, okay? So critical density, if you like, rho CW. So if I fix my W, which is the chipping rate, chipping versus aggregation, and then I increase the density slowly. As long as the density is less than some critical value, I'm in a fluid phase. By that, I mean the single site mass distribution decays exponentially, okay? This is the curve here, log log plot, rho less than rho C. Then, as I arrive at the critical point, so I'm going vertically like this, so as I arrive at the critical point exactly, so what you find is that this becomes a power law, and this is a finite size cutoff. Okay, so forget about this part for the moment. So this is just rho equal to rho C, and then I increase the density beyond the critical point, rho bigger than rho C. So what you find that this part of the spectrum or the this part does not change at all. It's exactly identical as rho equal to rho C. But, so then you ask what happens to the extra mass, because, you know, my density is given by the sum rule, that is MPMDM. So, how can, you know, I'm increasing the density, rho is becoming bigger than rho C. So, then PM, how can it not change? The point is, it's mathematically, it's more or less similar to the Bose-Einstein condensation. Basically, what happens is that there's an integral here, which saturates to its final, you know, value. So, all the rest of the mass goes into this extra bit. And this extra bit, basically what you see is that, so this bit does not change, but you get this bump here, okay? So this is the condensate bump that I was referring to in my previous slides. So this additional object that you get, all the extra mass is going to sit there at rho minus rho C times L. Yes?
Does this power law decay have a finite area under it so that in the thermodynamic limit you still have this, the condensation is independent of your system size? Finite size effects regular.
Yeah, no, so that's exactly what I was going to. So basically, you know, if you look at this bump, it's of this form, you know, this is centered at rho minus rho C times L with a width, which is usually typically a power of the system size, okay? Now, if you take this object, and so this is what I call the condensate bump, that is this bump. So if you now integrate this object, you find this is of order 1 over L, okay, which means that the probability that there is a condensate is 1 over L. That means there is only one condensate in your system. Okay. And if you take the first moment, that is if you multiply it by M and then integrate, this actually gives exactly rho minus rho C times L. Okay. So that means the extra mass actually goes there. the extra mass is actually carried, the area under this bump carries extra mass, and the location of the bump is at exactly at rho minus rho c times L. Okay.
What's the size of that specific system where that?
This one?
Yeah, showing where that cutoff is.
You mean this this cutoff here?
Yeah. So what would L be for that particular?
Oh, for this L, I don't remember now, but it's something like of the order of 2,000, 5,000. You can start seeing that actually. Okay. As you increase L, what happens is that of course this is at rho minus rho C L. So as you increase L, this bump keeps shifting. Okay. And this part also extends here like this.
Empirically, okay. How do you find the condensate grow in probability?
You mean the height? No, the total area under the condensate, okay, is always rho minus rho c, okay, because that's extra mass. But the height, of course, depends on L. Okay, I'll come to that later, maybe in my this thing. So let me just very quickly tell you what are the known results. So again, in this model, you can prove that the multipoint correlations actually do not factorize, which means that the product measure is not exact. Okay. But as in the asymmetric random average process, if you assume that the product measure factorizes, then you can actually calculate analytically this distribution of this single point distribution in the thermodynamic limit, and the results are that you find that this decay is like for rho less than rho c. So you can calculate within this mean field theory, you can calculate the rho c, which turns out to be just square root of w plus 1 minus 1. And so this decays exponentially with the power law prefactor for rho less than rho c. Exactly at rho equal to rho c, it goes like 1 over n to the power 5 by 2. And for rho bigger than rho c, it's 1 over 5 by 2 plus the condensate. Now, when I say plus the condensate, I mean this extra additional bump, which of course, these calculations are done in thermodynamic limit. So you can't really, for that you need a finite size effect, which I'll come back to later, actually how to calculate this extra bit basically. Okay. So, but within this grand canonical picture, where you have already taken the thermodynamic limit, all you know is that, there must be something additional, and the something additional is the condensate that you see. Now, what is remarkable is that you can actually calculate the phase diagram here, that means the locus of this critical curve, rho CW. It turns out to be square root of W plus 1 minus 1. In all dimensions. Now, this is the result which is, which does not rely on the mean field. We prove this result completely independent of the mean field. Basically, the idea is that, again, you write down the master equation, and if you write down, for example, the two-point correlation function, then that involves three-point correlation function and so on. And, I don't want to get into the details, but basically, there is a particular one which does not solve the all correlation functions, but it somehow brings out the critical density exactly by solving this this hierarchy with a particular answers, and it turns out that this is just independent of the dimension D on a hypercubic lattice. Because recently, some Korean group, they have studied this on a network, so where it's heterogeneous, the degree of different points are different. So there, of course, this is not true. This result is true for all D, all dimensions. With a homogeneous graph, like hypercubic lattice, for example. Okay, so this is one sort of rather remarkable result, which is that the mean field phase diagram is actually phase diagram by mean field phase boundary is exact. And then you can ask, suppose we get this mean field result, and suppose we compare with the again like the true single site mass distribution, obtained numerically. Is it any good? It turns out again that it's extremely close for all M. Okay, I have maybe the picture. So these circles here are the result of the mean field calculation exactly for all M, and this line here. I don't know. There are different curves, but basically, this is in all dimensions basically. Okay, so in all dimensions, there are two curves here, which is one dimension and two dimension both. So it seems that the single site mass distribution itself is completely independent of dimension for all M. Okay. So it seems that it's very close to the single point mass distribution obtained by assuming product measure. Okay. So So again, we see this sort of similar scenario, that is, you know, even though the, you know, the joint distribution does not factorize, but the single point distribution seems to be given by more or less by the mean field M, you know, for all M, not just for large M. And so far I was talking about this model with a symmetric mass transfer. Now you can of course think of the asymmetric model also. In particular, it turns out that in 1D it's a very special case where there is no condensation. Okay, so if the masses move only in one direction as opposed to both sides, okay, so but this is a very special case of D equal to 1 where it turns out that there is no condensation. Essentially, but in a finite size system, what you find is that the phase diagram is something like this, but this phase boundary itself, you know, increases with system size as log L, basically. So as L goes to infinity, basically you only see the fluid phase. Okay. So, but this is a very special case with D equal to 1 asymmetric model, which various people have looked at also with David Mukamel and collaborators. Okay. So I have only 5 minutes, so let me just introduce you and then maybe next lecture I'll just start with again fresh as a zero range process. So zero range process is probably the most widely studied of the three, of all the models. And this is a stochastic process which was introduced by Spitzer in the 70s. And subsequently it has been studied both by mathematicians and physicists. And there's a very nice recent review by Martin and Tom Hannay, which I recommend very strongly. It's a very, very nice review article. And so what is zero-range process? Again, you consider a ring of L sites. Now, again, you can define this model, all these models in any arbitrary dimension, but for simplicity, I always restrict myself to one dimension. So you have a ring of L sites. And again, at each site, you define some MI, which is some discrete mass, for example. And again, the total mass, which is the summation MI, is conserved by the dynamics. And what is the dynamics? So dynamics is the following. So first, think of the parallel dynamics. I mean, you can again define in a similar way the continuous time and the discrete time dynamics. So the discrete time dynamics, all you do is at each step, you just, with probability UMI, you just move, you just take one guy from here, the top guy, and just chip off to its neighbor. But it does not happen with constant rate. It happens with a rate that or probability that depends on how many particles are there already at that site. Okay, and so it's some function of the number of particles that are already existing at site I. Okay, and in the discrete time case, this object, since it's a probability, it is less than 1. Okay, so with probability UMI, you actually move. So from each site, for example, here it's a 4 site, so U of 4. Here it's a 3 site, so U of 3. So this U function does not depend, well, for the moment it does not depend on the sites. It's the same for all sites. So given this function, you just move this guy with probability UMI, and with probability 1 minus UMI, you don't do anything. Okay. So and you update each sites at the same time. Okay. And if you go to the continuous time, you just have to replace this probability UMI it should be some another function, but I just write it for the sake of simplicity. It's just, you just replace this guy by UMI times delta t, as Hai Hinrichsen was saying the other day. You always have to multiply with the delta t if you are going to the continuous time case. And when you go to the continuous time case, then of course this UMI, there is no restriction that it has to be less than 1. It can be any function, actually, any positive function. And so in a time step delta t, in the continuous time, what you do is you just move one single particle from I to I plus 1, and with probability 1 minus UMI delta t, you do nothing. Okay, so that's all. So this is a very simple dynamics. And in particular, when the rate function is 1, it reduces to asymmetric exclusion process on M plus M side, because that's very simple to see. Because what happens is that all these models, actually, you can think of some kind of generalized asymmetric exclusion process, because what happens is that, okay, so you have these sites here, and let's say these are my particles. So now think of, so you have L sites and let's say N number of particles. Now think of a lattice which has m plus l number of sites. Okay. So the particle here, the sites here, I represent them by particles. Okay. So this one corresponds to here, this one corresponds to here. And I just put the mass here. So for example, here you have three mass, so I just put three holes here. Okay. Here I have four mass, so I put four holes here. Then I have three again, and so on. Okay. Now, if you have a single particle going this way, for example, with some rate, so that means that, you know, in this picture, that means essentially that this object here moved one step to the left. Okay. Because now, in the new configuration, there will be three holes in front of this particle, okay, and four in front of this, which effectively means that this particle moves to the left one unit. And so if um in general, you know, means that the rate of by which a single particle goes to an empty neighbor, that depends on the size of the, you know, the cluster in front of the site, the size of the whole cluster in front of the particle, basically. Okay. So, and if particularly if this um is equal to 1, then that just means it's the constant rate. So that means, you know, it's just a asymmetric exclusion process. The masses are moving this way, the particles are moving this way on this bigger lattice. And so it's an asymmetric exclusion process on a lattice with m plus l sites. Okay. Maybe I should just stop here, and I'll continue with the zero range process in my next talk, and then it will go from there. Okay, thank you very much.
Question about the distinction between condensation transitions and ordinary phase separation.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to define the condensate as having an extensive density on an order one number of sites.
Right.
So, for example, in a traffic jam, you might expect a finite density on an extensive number of sites.
Well, in the examples, I mean, you know, there are examples where actually you have condensation on a finite number of sites. Okay. But in most of the examples I'll talk about here. Okay. Where actually the condensate, there will be only one condensate. Okay, so you see, you know, it's something like New York City, for example. Okay, so if you look at the buildings in New York City, and then you see that there are these tall buildings basically, and there is one New Empire State Building, for example. Okay, one huge tall building which is like the condensate essentially, and it's usually always one basically.
Can I just follow that? What I was asking about, is there a physical difference between having a condensate on one or an order one number of sites and having phase separation where you have the phase occupying an extensive number of sites?
Oh, I see. No, but that, you know, for example, phase separation, okay, as David and collaborators have studied quite extensively, I mean, phase separation, for example, I mean, you know, just think of this picture here, okay? I mean, here, when you have a phase separation, you have a big domain here, right, which actually becomes a single site mass distribution in the other picture, okay? So in that sense, you just lay it down essentially. So,
okay, so time for lunch, I guess.